Well, thank you, David, and good afternoon, and welcome everyone to our study of the original dictation of A Course in Miracles. And let's just do a test here to make sure you can hear me. Testing, testing, one, two, three. Can anybody hear me? Yes, good. All right. Sometimes that doesn't happen. My name is Doug Thompson, and my co-host is Deborah Maltman. I want to start today's program with a reminder of why we have come together to share in the study of the words Jesus dictated to Helen and Bill. Jesus said, "Wherever two or more are gathered together, there also shall I be." And I not only believe he said that, I believe he is here with us. Jesus also said, quoting from the Gospel of Matthew, "Inasmuch as you do it unto the least of these, my children, you do it unto me." In the Course, in T1B23E, which we'll actually be reading today, he tells us that it really ends with, "You do it unto yourself and me." "Inasmuch as you do it unto the least of these, my brethren, you do it unto yourself and me." What we're doing here is both for our own learning and that of everyone. And I want to express my deep gratitude for the many contributions which have come from the audience over the months. This work, is far more accurate, and certainly my own understanding is a lot better for those contributions. As most of you know, the Course exists in a number of versions as a result of very extensive editing and abridgment over the years. While anyone looking at the earliest raw handwritten form will recognize that it certainly needed some editing, some of that editing ended up blurring and obscuring points which were originally much clearer. One reason for studying this material is that it gives us a clearer picture, not only of what Jesus originally said, but in his sidebar explanations to Helen and Bill, what he really meant. Some of us have found that clarity of understanding to be useful. The earliest written record of A Course in Miracles is found in two collections of Helen Schuckman's manuscript, her original shorthand notes and her later edited transcript known as the Urtext. Now, hardly a week passes that somebody doesn't ask me about other versions of the Course, which are also advertised or labeled as in some way original. There are actually six different versions of the text of the Course of which I'm aware, and five for which I have been able to obtain copies. Most of these have been published, and in most cases, the publisher claims each is in some way original. This can cause confusion. So what we're working with today is actually the original in the sense of being what was originally written down by Helen Schuckman before the editing process began. For the past few months, I've been going through the notes, which is the earliest form, and identifying material which did not make it into the Urtext, the second earliest form, and combining these two and most original versions. The resulting document, which we'll be reading today, is therefore not any one of the five known scribal versions, but rather a combination of the two earliest ones. It includes essentially all of the original dictation for which we have any documentary evidence. This material does have some rough spots, some segments which were written down only in point form, and some sentences which were never completed. In that sense, it certainly does need some editing in places, in that it is not a finished product. The notes also include some material specifically labeled as a private point and not part of the Course. This includes conversations between Helen and Jesus about topics of concern to Helen at the time. Some of the material is clearly Helen's own authorship and not that of Jesus. While not part of the Course proper, these outtakes, or sidebars, if you will, provide considerable insight into Helen's experience and often involve explanations of miracle principles, practical examples from Helen's own life, and as such expand our understanding of both the Course proper and the scribing experience, which resulted in what we know of today as A Course in Miracles. So what we're doing today will be a reading, some commentary, and discussion of this material. Last week we got as far as T1B23D, and the link will, okay, there's the link there now. And we're planning to pick up today where we left off last week. The first 8 chapters of this combined original dictation are available on the net at the URL just posted. For those on the radio who can't see that, you can get to it by going to www.miraclesinactionpress.com/DTHOMP74. In the left-hand navigation pane, click on Original Dictation Text 1-8, and you'll be at the document. Now, the basic format we're using is reading and commentary plus discussion. There tends to be a lot more commentary and discussion than reading many times. While I'd encourage everybody to raise your hand if you have something to share, I'd appreciate it if you try to keep your comments focused. Try to keep it under 3 minutes unless something truly exceptional arises, which it sometimes does. Deborah will be keeping an eye on the hands on the board, and she is like the chairperson here. When she acknowledges your hand and drops the mic, then you can take the mic. If, when you have the mic, either Deborah or I raise our hands, please conclude your remarks and drop the mic. Towards the end of the 2 hours, I'll be asking for questions, and I'll make an attempt to summarize the key points of what we've covered in this session. And at this point, I'm going to hand the mic to Deborah for her introductory comments. Here you go, Deb.
Thanks, Doug. Can everybody hear me? I'll just wait for that. Yes, or why? Yeah, thank you. Okay, and I'll start with, again, sort of touching in with myself. And this is very helpful for me, so I hope it's okay with you all that I'm doing this. I'm sure it addresses for other people inside themselves, I'm sure. I can't be standing solo in this, no way. So it's been this progression of feeling more relaxed with in this type of a setup and taking the mic and reading and just being here. And also the progression is being present in this kind of a situation, which has been very difficult for me because I fragmented incredibly initially and I couldn't even look at the board. that was way too scary. So and last week it got to the point where this rather than this tight nervousness in my solar plexus had shifted to this excitement in my heart, but still this, okay, what do I do with this? I'm still in this kind of roller coaster, which I am this week too. But during the session last week, it also shifted into this expansion of warmth and where my heart let go and into this healing energy and it was pumping all through me through the last of the sessions. It was very nice and very welcome. And then this week, it's still a little touch of a roller coaster mixed in with this heat that is integrating and helping the rest come forth that is in the resistance of me. So that's all in this motion forward still, and I'm very excited about it. It's been very helpful, very healing, very, very healing. You're welcome. Thanks for letting me share that. And so what and the second thing is I'm touching in on what I'd like to say, help me to perform whatever miracles you want of me today. When I started saying that, excuse me, in this room before sessions, I know it's in the afternoon here, in the morning some other places, evening some other places, but it just feels a thing to do that brings it back to my mind all the time. And I chose to work with that so that I would help myself to remember to say that daily, because that is a request by Jesus that we do say that every day. And I wasn't doing that, and I couldn't get myself to do that, so I was learning to be there with it. So then as I'm hearing myself say this on Sundays, then I got finally to the point where I thought, I will write it down and set it beside my bed, which I did, and still didn't see it, still didn't read it. I completely did not see it there until a few mornings ago, and I rolled over and my eyes fell on it, and here it sits with my good morning. Help me to perform whatever miracles you want of me today. It hit me deep, this deep opening, and I went, yay, wow, it happened. And it's been happening since, and it's been happening just spontaneously. I don't even have to see it. It just comes in. So it's been very useful for me, and hopefully it is for others as well, as that reminder so that your mind can latch on to it, attached to all the wonderful things, right? Well, it's only attachment for a little while, and then we let that go too, so no fear with it. And the second thing is, Lord, heal me. So, and then I just ask for everyone to come together in this gathering so that each of us use the opportunity to turn our attention inward to receive divine guidance in whatever way you receive it. If it's Holy Spirit, if it's Jesus, if it's soul to soul, your inner soul loading the information to you, bringing it forth, go with it. And Doug, if there's nothing else you want to say, I just wanted to ask everyone as well, is there any questions about any of the introduction that has been given to you? And if so, raise your hand or shoot the question onto the board. And if not, then I guess we will begin. Doug has posted with your search, Control plus F button, you can search for B23E and get right to that point. That will be on the link that he's posted. Thanks, Carmen. And so welcome, everybody. Hi. And I'm going to start reading with TB23E then. I know I had posted N1, but I may as well go right straight to the 23E. I am in charge of the process of atonement, which I undertook to begin. My atonement was for the canceling out of all sins, parentheses, in effect, lack of love, close parentheses, which human beings could not otherwise correct. That is what the biblical statement, underneath are the everlasting arms, means. 23E-N1, which is from the notes, I would have undone Esther's sin to everyone who was affected by it myself, of course, but this would not have helped you. The reason it was a miracle was because it not only atoned for Esther, but also for you, because it kept two children from harm. I could have secured a new grant for the shield anyway, because being a board member of NIH, but this way I could cancel out some of your sins as well as Esther's, and I sit on your boards too. And Doug, your hand's up, here's the mic.
Oh, there's some lovely little bits here. I just wanted to point out, for those who might not know, that the material in italics, in bold italics, is material from the shorthand notes that was not included in the urtext. The regular type material is generally, it's basically both in the notes and the urtext. Sometimes there's minor differences between the two. In this document, I've only stressed significant differences, and mostly that's material that was simply omitted altogether. In a few cases, it's substantial differences in wording. And I want to note that in that first paragraph, we have sin being redefined as lack of love. Later on, the word sin basically drops out entirely, except as kind of a parody, or used in a facetious sense. And we also note in the discussion of the Shield Project, one of Jesus' common attributes, basically making puns or statements with double meaning or metaphorical. In the Shield, I understand, was a journal or a newsletter relating to child psychology. And the NIH, I believe, refers to the National Institutes of Health, and Jesus is saying he's a board member. And he sits on your boards, too, referring to Helen and Esther. Indicating, I think this connects with his statement earlier, that he's in charge of space and time. And he says quite bluntly here, I could have secured the new grant for the shield anyway. Which tells us something about who Jesus is and how he operates in space and time, which I find quite interesting. And yeah, Carmen, on our boards too, Carmen has written, and our boards too, LOL. Yes, I think that that is the point that's made here. Yeah. Okay. Deborah, here's the mic back.
Okay, the reason, The reason you found rewriting that so taxing was because you resented Esther's sin and thought she put you in a very unfair position. But no one can really do this to anybody. If you had known that you were really performing a miracle for the shield, for Esther, for yourself, and for me, you would have done it with real joy. Parentheses, Helen Schuckman, explanation. This means that he will backstop whenever human miracles will not suffice for human purposes. However, it is perfectly clear that when a person can atone by miracles, both giver and receiver are atoning. It is better to atone this way because of the mutual benefits involved. Close parentheses. Inasmuch as you do it unto the least of my children, really ends with, you do it unto yourself and me. The reason why you come before me is because I do not need miracles for my own atonement, but I stand at the end in case you fail temporarily. 23E N2. I am always here to protect against assumption failure. Parentheses. That's a special pun for Bill. He is still under the impression that he needs special signs of love. Close parentheses. Yeah, he will backstop for us. That's phenomenal, eh? That's really great. 23N3. Note also that the special language here is a combination of both yours and his. You two come together in my name. 23EN4. Question. Are there any corrections you want me to make in this? 23F. Special explanation. Doug, here's the mic.
Yeah. Apologies there for the typo in the previous paragraph, but no one... If you do a refresh, it'll now read correctly. I made the correction earlier today, but I didn't upload the file to the website. I just did now. There was a typo there. The actual reading is, but no one really does this to anybody. And it said no one can really does this to anybody. I'm not quite sure how that happened. Yeah, the backstop idea is crucial. And the assumption failure. I'm not sure how familiar people are with that term. I wasn't when I first read this. I had to go look it up. Assumption failure is a scientific term which relates to planning and research methodology where you make basic assumptions about your data. You assume that a certain source is reliable, for instance. And if you discover later on that your assumption was incorrect and that the data coming from that instrument or source was not as reliable as you thought, you have an assumption failure which throws your whole methodology into doubt. And for research scientists such as Bill, assumption failure is a major issue that they have to monitor as they're evaluating data and trying to draw conclusions from it. And this is therefore a special pun for Bill, given because he's under the impression he still needs special signs of love. And in the second paragraph there, the special language here, and by special language I think it means things like assumption failure, particular terms that are particularly meaningful to either Helen or Bill in the moment, because they're working with a particular scientific language. So it's a combination of both yours, Helen, and his, Bill's. You two come together in my name, referring back to that quote from Matthew 18:20, which I read earlier, for where two or three are gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them. That would be, I believe, a reference to that idea. Okay. Deborah.
Oh, Carmen, you have your hand up. Here's the mic.
Hi. Just wanted to say one thing. The business about Jesus will backstop for us has been really, really, really helpful for me ever since we got the Urtex. The idea that it's the ego that wants to do miracles to be special, to get it that this is a team effort. Backstop being a sports term for someone assisting, I think. At least that's how I understand it. To see that Jesus is acting like the backboard in a basketball game, that he will take our efforts that may be slightly off hitting a basket and bounce it back into the basket, or another team member. It gives that idea of cooperation and miracles just an added oomph for me. So I can't tell you how many times that thought that he is backstopping for me and that we're a team doing this has just really meant all the difference in the world to seeing miracles. And it kind of humbles the ego a little bit for me. And I just wanted to emphasize that. So thank you so much for letting me have that time. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Carmen, for adding that. And that it really is an important point, which I kind of glossed over because there were so many other points. One of the fascinating things about this material is practically every phrase is a universe of meaning in itself. There is so much meaning packed into such a small number of words that there's layers within layers within layers. But yeah, that backstop function and the quote from Deuteronomy, I believe, about the everlasting arms, underneath are the everlasting arms, is when Helen uses a number of times, and apparently was very meaningful to her, that those everlasting arms, the divine arms, are there to catch us if we fall, or with a similar metaphor, like a backstop, if the ball overshoots, if our efforts, you know, miss the mark, Jesus is standing there to catch us if we fall, in essence. Dust us off and set us back on track. All right, Deborah.
Okay. 23F, special explanation. In response to Helen... parentheses, in response to Helen Schuckman's request regarding possible corrections, close parentheses, change the word sin to absence of love. Sin is a man-made word with threat connotations, which he made up himself. No real threat is involved anywhere. Just because nature abhors a vacuum, which is true enough, it does not follow that a vacuum is filled with hellfire. Nothing is gained by frightening yourself, and it is very destructive. Miracles need freedom from fear. part of their atonement value involves just that. Note that the word atone really means undo. Doug, here's the mic.
Well, once again, we have sin being redefined as absence of love. And the reason being explained here, sin is a man-made word with threat connotations, which man made up himself. And sin, it's actually funny. In Greek, in the Greek New Testament, the word translated into English as sin usually is an archery term which means missing the mark. And it doesn't have anywhere near the guilt and fear connotation that the English word sin does today. Over time, the idea that making an error is unforgivable and results in eternal condemnation, it's a notion that you almost don't find in the Bible. Errors get punished in the Old Testament, reprimanded, have consequences, but the idea of eternal damnation is almost absent in the Bible. It does pop up a couple of times, kind of, sort of. But in medieval Christianity, the notion of when you die, you either go to heaven and your reward or eternal punishment in a sea of fire, that notion is relatively modern and has gotten attached to the word sin in English, such that when we read the New Testament in an English translation that uses the word sin, we're not getting the sense that a first century Greek speaker would have got listening to St. Paul talk about sin. St. Paul was talking about mistakes, missing the mark, an error. By definition, something that's correctable. If you try again, you're likely to get it right, as opposed to something which, whoops, it's over for you. You missed the mark. You go burn. And so Jesus here is basically correcting that misunderstanding of sin, and he does that largely by ditching the word and using words like error and mistake and correction, all of which imply something correctable as opposed to something for which there is no remedy. And then I think a very important line here, miracles need freedom from fear. And this relates to another miracle principle, which I don't have in front of me right now, that makes the same point. When we are filled with fear, something happens in the human mind that tends to block sensibility, tends to block rationality, tends to block our intelligence. Never mind communication with the divine. When we are fearful, we are believing that something terrible is going to happen, and or could happen, and that blocks the capacity to communicate effectively with other people. It blocks the capacity to communicate effectively with God or hear from the Holy Spirit. And so it blocks miracle-mindedness. It prevents us from being a channel of the divine through which Jesus can act to can act to heal through ourselves. So nothing is gained by frightening yourself. In fact, it's destructive. And what it destroys is the capacity to perceive correctly and the capacity to receive divine guidance. Miracles need freedom from fear, and part of their atonement value involves just that. Now, just that, the atonement value of the miracle involves just that freedom from fear. And then he offers this definition of atone, which means undo, which is actually pretty much, again, in terms of the linguistic history of the word atone, which was coined in 1527 by William Tyndale, who was looking for an English equivalent for a Greek word that has to do with restoration and reconciliation of a schism that has been created. So it means undoing a schism. When a conflict has broken out between two people, the healing of that conflict is what Tyndale meant by the word atone. It means undo the schism. Yet in later English usage, the word atone has come to mean something like pay a debt. If you commit a sin, you must atone for your violation the way you pay a fine if you break the parking laws. You know, you park in the wrong place, you've got to go pay a fine. You atone for your crime. And that notion of paying a debt is absolutely not present in either the Greek New Testament or in Tyndale's mind, I'm sure, when he coined the word atone and atonement. It meant undoing the breach in relationship, ultimately the breach in relationship between man and God, the separation, in other words, undoing it so as to restore the original loving relationship that had been damaged or separated. So yes, it means undoing the damage. And this is really critical, because if we take the word atone in its more recent sense as being pay your debts, something you do to compensate for wrongdoing, we miss the point entirely of what was intended in the New Testament by the New Testament authors, and what is clearly intended by Jesus when he uses the word atone here, and he spells it out. Atone means undo. Doesn't mean pay for your sins. It means undo the separation, ultimately. And this is going to be expanded a great deal as we go on, so I'm going to give the mic back to Deborah to continue reading, because Jesus says it better than I do. And he's about to say it.
I have a little bit to add in there, too, because when I read, change the word sin to absence of love, it just hits really deep. It's such a deep wound in all of us, where we we're reaching out for love. There's that lack of love going on, that need of love, trying to get love, and we are pushed down for being something that we aren't. We are created a further separation by the reaction that we are given. And this is all correcting that. And so it's touching in that deep wounding place and bringing that up and exposing it for healing. So I'm just really touching down with that as these words are being read. So I'll carry on here. 23G. The purpose of the atonement is to restore everything to you. Parentheses, that is, to restore the awareness, later clarification, close parentheses. You had everything when you were created, just as everyone did. 23H. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, this line is really important, too, as an interpretive tool for many things that come later in the course. I think everybody who's studied the course has run into this apparent contradiction between various affirmations that you have everything, the script has already been written, you are the Holy Son of God, perfect in every way, then how come if I have everything, I'm hungry and nobody's feeding me? How come if I'm perfect in every way, everybody's criticizing me and I'm making mistakes? How come I don't feel saved? How come... Okay, that is to restore the awareness, okay? The purpose of the atonement is to restore the awareness of everything to you. So there's a correction here that is basically being dictated. And in reality, at the soul level, we have everything and nothing is lost. At the ego level, or the level of perception, we're not always aware of that. And one goal of the course is to bring our awareness in line with reality so that we're aware of the truth. The fact that I'm hungry is is, for instance, an illusion. It seems as if I'm hungry. At the level of perception, I'm hungry. I'm not really hungry. And when the perception is corrected, the miracle acts to bring that which is perceived in line with that which is real. Thus you get miracle healings and various suspensions of apparent natural laws. And that is really important in understanding all these statements in the Course, and there are a great many, that say things which appear to our senses not to be true, such as, you know, you're perfect, or you have everything. Wait a minute, I don't. I'm not. Well, actually you are, it's just that you're not aware of it. And with the Holy Spirit's intervention and the correction of perception, that awareness eventually materializes. Okay. Yeah, the kingdom is here, but we're not always aware that, you know, heaven is as close to you as your right hand. It's within you. Don't go looking for it here or there. It's right here. And people look around and say, well, wait a minute, this doesn't look like heaven to me. Okay, it doesn't. But that only means you're not aware of it. It doesn't mean it's not actually there. Okay. That's what I had to say about that. Deborah, take it away.
Oh, I look to living in that state all of the time, Carmen. Doug, I just thought of the mic, or not the mic, the recording. I was just wondering if it's working. I don't know why it just came into mind, so I'll leave that with you. I'll continue reading. 23H, having been restored to your original state, you naturally become part of the atonement yourself. You now share my inability to tolerate the lack of love in yourself and in everyone else, and must join the great crusade to correct it. The slogan for this crusade is listen, learn, and do. 23I. Thanks, Doug. This means listen to my voice, learn to undo the error, and do something to correct it. 23J. The first two are not enough. The real members of my party are active workers. 23K. The power to work miracles belongs to you. I will create the right opportunities for you to do them, but you must be ready and willing to do them since you are already able to. Doing them will bring conviction in the ability. I repeat that you will see miracles through your hands, through mine. Conviction really comes through accomplishment. Remember that ability is the potential. Achievement is its expression, and atonement is the purpose. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay. I repeat, you will see miracles through your hands, through mine. That is actually the opening line of A Course in Miracles. The first page of Helen's notebook on October 21st, 1965, begins with those words, or very close to those words. You will see miracles through your hands, through me, is how it's originally written. The theme is repeated and shows up in the second to last line of The Gifts of God, which is kind of an epilogue to the entire course, and extended, that you will see miracles through your hands, through mine. We'll get to The Gifts of God another time. And I think that this message that the course begins with in its original form and is repeated and stressed here is that we do miracles as a kind of wire. And Jesus is the battery providing the electricity that moves through us and out into the appliance, which is the receiver of the miracle. And there's many points in the miracle principles that stress this idea that the miracles don't originate with us. In fact, we shouldn't even be consciously attempting a miracle. But insofar as we're conscious, making ourselves available, making our love available, because it's through our love. Our love is the conductor of Jesus' healing energy. Can move through our love to manifest miracles in the environment around us through us. And this is a really, really key concept about what a miracle is. And I want to sort of add that stress to it. So the power to work miracles belongs to you. And the power to work miracles is your capacity to love. I will create the right opportunities for you to do them. Okay, I don't have to create the opportunities for me to do miracles. I simply have to wait to be told, this is the opportunity. But for that to work, you must be ready and willing to do them, since you're already able. So our task, our assignment here is to maintain ourselves, is to get to a state of readiness and willingness, and then maintain that state of readiness and willingness. And that basically means a state of love, a state of the awareness of love's presence. And most of the course is about removing the obstacle, teaching us how the obstacles to the awareness of love's presence can be removed. In other words, this paragraph is basically setting out the agenda. You must be ready and willing, but by implication, you're not always. And I don't know, is anybody else here not always ready and willing? You're not always, and therefore, we have this course here to teach you how to achieve readiness and willingness such that you can be a conduit of miracles. And then the repetition of you will see miracles through your hands, through mine, and your conviction will come through your accomplishment. As you experience this happening, you will actually believe it. Right now, we're taking it on Jesus' words, or Helen and Bill are taking it on Jesus' words, but he's telling them, you're going to develop a conviction that this is true through accomplishment or through your experience of its happening. So the ability is the potential, achievement is its expression, and the ultimate purpose is atonement or undoing the rift, the separation. That's what a miracle's ultimate purpose is. Whatever it does in the moment, its ultimate purpose is atonement or undoing the illusion of separation, alienation, and the ultimate obstacle to the awareness of love's presence. Deborah.
Carmen, you have something to share. Go ahead. Here's the mic.
Oh, thank you. I would like to share something here really briefly because Eve asked when she first came in the room if my miracles were working. My miracles, put in quotes because it's our miracles. I wanted to share that because I used that repeated saying, you will see miracles through your hands, through mine, for the first major healing miracle that I ever saw as a result of studying the course. A friend of mine called and said that her ex-husband was in the hospital and that the doctors had given up on him. And she asked me to go down to the ICU and go in there as his minister and pray for him, see if I could get a miracle. And my ego just went crazy. And he was like, you know, oh, there, you know, this is where the rubber hits the road. You're going to fail. You know, this is too much to ask of you. The course, you know, I've been teaching people for years that the power to work miracles belongs to you, but here somebody's asking me to demonstrate it, and it was like, ah! So anyway, it to make a long story short, I did manage to get into ICU, even though I wasn't a member of the family. Just miracles got me in there, and I was standing there looking at this person who was on total life support, and it looked like a beach dolphin. I mean, he was just bloated, white as a sheet. He had this gray mist floating over his face. And I'm like, what the heck do I do? And that saying, you will see miracles through your hands, through mine, came into my head. And it was like Jesus was standing behind me, and I visualized that his hands were on top of mine. And I asked what to do, and I got to take this huge bloated hand that was taped to a pillow and hold it in my hands and just with my mind touch this person and ask him if he was willing to come back and be there for his two teenage sons who needed him desperately and who wanted to be a family with him. And the next day I got a phone call that he had opened his eyes. The doctors had said if he survived he was going to be a vegetable, but apparently he was trying to laugh at jokes his sons were cracking with the tube down his throat, and it was causing him some problems, so they took the tube out. A week later he walked out of the hospital, and that image of Jesus standing behind me with his hands over my hands is something that stayed with me to this day as a very clear experience. And I just wanted to share that, of how literally he means that, and to share with people like Eve that this stuff really does work, and you do gain a belief in the invisible when you see its results like that. So anyway, thank you. I'll get out of the way.
That's beautiful, Carmen. Thank you so much for sharing that. That's so terrific. There's a practical occurrence that I wanted to share as well. And this is so wonderful that you shared it in that way, that specific way. And what I'm going to share shows a bit of a difference, because it didn't end result of the person who was dying in a dying process survived in his physical body. And it was a real learning experience for me, a real learning curve, in that a friend of mine, a very dear to my heart friend, two or three years ago now that he passed away, but in his process, he had hepatitis C, and it was in the third year. And he had no real connection. He always pushed aside the spiritual connection and anything that was ever said about God or healing or anything. He just pushed it aside and didn't want to look at it. And I had the strong urge to suggest to him that I send some distant treatments to him. He lived across the country. And I talked it over with his partner, and he said, well, if she goes for it, then I'll go for it, but I'll let you two discuss it. And we did. And she really wanted me to send healing to him. At the time, I was working with Ornan DeBene's work and also incorporating that with healing energy such as Reiki. So I started sending him treatments every morning, and watched as all of these creatures, like insects, were coming out of his field, coming from the physical depiction of him in my mind, and stripping off of him and leaving. There was lots of them, and they would leave, and then they started to really peter out. So there was the odd one that was leaving, but they were still coming. And then I got the message to stop. And I'm thinking, what do you mean stop? This is working, and something's working here. And I was told to stop. And then I was also told that he needs to be in touch with this process. He needs to connect with this process. It's his learning curve in here. And so I stopped and I let it go. I mean, this has been very difficult for my ego, very difficult, because I was hesitant to relinquish my actions, but I was also following that inner guidance the way that I am taught I should be following it, because I'm not in charge of that. I'm not in charge of the process. I don't know where the healing is happening for whoever it's happening for, and sometimes not even aware, most times we're not even aware of the healing that is happening, that is rolling from us. So a couple weeks, my time will be off, but anyways, later, a number of days later, my friend called me and he said, I need to ask you, did you stop your work? And I said, I did. And I said, what's going on? He said, well, I was doing so well, he said, and I was getting up and about. And he said, I had more energy than I'd ever had. And then everything started to reverse. And I wanted to know if you had stopped. And I said, I did. And I was honest with him, and I told him what my inner guidance was. And it was for him, and it was for him to connect with. And he did pass away. But when he went for the next round of his medications from the doctors, they said they hardly found any of the virus in there, but they couldn't get it. They couldn't they just couldn't get the last little bit of it, and he did pass away. So I wanted to share that because it's out of my hands, right? It was out of my hands, and I'm still learning that. I'm still not totally willing to let go of all of that sense of my ego attachment in that. Anyways, Doug, here's the mic.
Well, thank you very much for those stories, Carmen and Deborah. And I appreciate in particular the nuances in your story, Deborah, because it illustrates an important point about miracles. If at my ego level I had the capacity to perform miracles at will, I would cure every problem I saw, everything I thought was a problem. And the world, through my miraculous powers, would quickly conform to my ego's judgment of what is good and what is bad. And I'm willing to bet that 10 years into the process, you guys would all be shuddering in your boots. Because I might like it, though I doubt I would. At the ego level, at the level of perception even, at the physical level of perception, what we think is good and what we think is bad is all screwed up. And we don't understand the big picture, God's perfect plan. Jesus does understand that, which is why he's in charge of the atonement process and I'm not. And that's why he tells his brothers, you and I, not to perform miracles, not to attempt to perform miracles on our own, from our own will, based on our judgments of what's good and what's bad. In the cosmic scheme of things, sometimes a given soul needs the experience that he is experiencing at the moment for a particular kind of learning. And if I were to interrupt that by fixing his flat tire, I would just get in the way, because the flat tire is actually an opportunity that's been given him for some kind of learning. And the same would go for a physical illness. What we have to remember is that the body is a temporary learning device that we have been given to use to communicate and to learn things with. And the death of the body is, Jesus says a number of times in the Course, no more significant than casting off an outworn garment. It is compared to what I'm about to do with my old winter coat. It's worn out. When this season's done, it goes into the garbage, and I'll be looking for a new one for next winter. And it's hardly to be considered a catastrophe. It's something we do all the time, right? We wear out our clothes and we replace them. And the same with bodies. They're teaching devices, they're instruments, and it is so common that from the ego's point of view, and the ego thinks, I am a body, and it thinks, you are a body, that a problem with the body is the worst thing that can happen. And we must go to the greatest of lengths to mend or cure or rectify, essentially fix the old coat and try to keep it going. God's plan works in different ways. So sometimes an illness or an apparent physical disaster, Jesus doesn't want us to miraculously remedy it. Yet, even in that situation, there can be miraculous intervention in terms of soul healing, in terms of the exchange of love, in terms of providing comfort and reassurance, in terms of helping to reduce fear. There's all manner of things short of, you know, spontaneous mending the broken leg that the miracle can manifest. And I particularly appreciate Deborah's report there, because it really shows us that issue. There was the possibility there for her, using her mind and her desire to heal her friend, to do it. But that wasn't God's plan, and that wasn't ultimately in the friend's best interests. Okay, that's what I wanted to say about that one. So we have to, I guess I'm thinking in particular of those people, myself sometimes included, sitting in hospitals with a friend or loved one who is ill, and you want to do something for them, and look to Jesus in that instrument, in that instant. And I mean, what Carmen did, taking her hand and taking the sick fellow's hand and saying, Jesus, let this be your hand, lets Jesus, gives the authorship of the event to Jesus. We become the vehicle, and whatever he wants will be right. And if we simply make ourselves available for that, it will be right. Sometimes what's right is that guy will get up and walk out of the hospital. Other times, there's a different agenda for that soul's particular learning curriculum. I did ask if I should go to the hospital first, Carmen says. Yeah. And I think that's an important, the importance of that cannot be underestimated. Hundreds of times in this book, Jesus tells Helen and the rest of us to ask first. It starts in chapter 1. The last time I think he does it is in chapter 30. I mean, ask first before you judge the situation, before you make up your mind about what's supposed to happen. Ask me first. And keep checking in. And I'll tell you what to do, when to do it, and when to stop. And if we do that, we are ready. And if we can't do that, we're not ready, and we're going to stumble. Quite simply, it won't work. And we'll wonder why. Well, wouldn't Jesus want to heal my friend? Well, healing your friend's body, it may not be what your friend needs. Jesus knows, I don't. So I think that this is like absolutely crucially important. Ask, 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 and don't stop asking. Because it's very, very easy for us with our desire to be helpful and our good intentions to get into our heads the idea that what Jesus wants is this guy's broken leg to be fixed. But that's what my ego wants. That may or may not be what Jesus wants. And we'll see. and knowing, having the faith in that situation to know that however it plays out, as long as we stay tuned to love, it will play out well. That the result will be often entirely unexpected, may include surprises we don't even like, but it will come out well, and the result will be the undoing of the separation for everybody concerned. And very frequently, Jesus tells us a number of times in the Course, there are benefits that occur to people we don't even know, and we're never even going to meet. That the miracle works in all dimensions across time. And actually, can transcend time. The miracle can undo the past in the present and release the future. And that in itself is a phenomenal concept, which I don't think I want to go into right now because I could spend a couple of hours on that. All right, Deborah, I'm going to give you back the mic. Because I'm wondering here. I just really want to thank you, Carmen, for mentioning that ask first. I think that is so important because it is so easy for a well-meaning person with good intentions to assume that what I think is good must be what Jesus thinks is good. And it's not always true. It is sometimes, but not always. Ergo, he tells us, ask, 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 ask. Okay, here's the mic, Deborah.
Thanks, Doug. And the healing is not one way. The healing is for ourselves as well. So there's a healing curve in there for me that Jesus was also working with, and I'm well aware of that. And also, every little instance or opportunity that is presented to us to work in this way with Jesus, then it's going to, as Jesus says, the conviction really comes through accomplishment. So any little bit of accomplishment in the process, that conviction comes in for us, so we can move forward knowing of that connection, that it's a for sure, that this is really something that we can really work with and let go into, and let Jesus take over and direct us. Christian, you have your hand up. I will give you the mic.
Thank you, Deborah. Yeah, well, I've been listening, and I'm hearing stories about healing of people from other people at the level of form. Well, who knows at what level, but resulting in healing of the body and so on. And I'm hearing Doug say, Jesus says, ask, ask, ask. And I'm aware that the Course in Miracles says that all events are planned. And so, Doug, I'm aware of a contradiction. If all events are planned, there's no need to ask, is there?
Well, this leads us into the theology of predestination, which is something I haven't looked at closely in 25 years. So it's not on the tip of my tongue. All things are planned, and ask, ask, ask. What is planned is that we will learn how to undo the separation illusion. What is planned is that Jesus is in charge of space and time. He's the planner. And he plans every instant for our learning. What he doesn't plan, and what I don't think he can plan, and what he frequently says he can't plan, is how we're going to respond to his instructions. We do have free will in time. And so we can, the plan is that the separation ends, atonement is complete, we all become aware of who and what we really are. That's the plan. That is planned. How we do it, because we're creatures of free will, is really up to us. If I decide not to ask Jesus, I can go and force him to create a really awkward plan for me. If I don't listen to him directly, he has to get through to me through disasters and catastrophes and illnesses and all manner of things to get my attention. So we are, at the soul level, one with God and one with Jesus. So we are also the planner in that sense, at our higher, the higher self is part of the planner. And the lower self, the ego self that needs the training and the learning, is what's being planned for. And the plan is a plan that gives us every opportunity we care to take to delay, defer, ignore, disobey, be unloving, be fearful, and experience the consequences of whatever we're doing. I would also point out, in relation to your first comment about healing in form and healing of the body, that we're told in the Course many times that the mind is the only creative level, and all healing occurs at the level of the mind. And if there's an illness, the cause isn't physical, it's mental. It's in the mind, that the body reflects our state of mind and our state of soul, perhaps, as well, but certainly state of mind. So even though we're speaking in terms of I prayed for the healing of a sick man and the sick man got better, measured in physical terms, if that healing did not occur at the level of his mind, he wouldn't have gotten better because his illness occurred at the level of his mind. So, you know, there's your friend sitting there with a broken leg and you want to help him. Of course, you're going to help him in all kinds of physical ways, provide him comfort and support, and bandages, and stop the bleeding, or, you know, do whatever. But you know that this broken leg is something his mind has created because he needs it. And if the mental need, if the mind need is healed, the physical symptom or reflection of that mind is no longer relevant. So the leg gets better. And if the leg doesn't get better, it's because the mind needs the experience. That's how I understand it anyways. And if we want to get into the theology of predestination, you're going to have to give me a week to brush up on it. Okay, Deborah, here's the mic.
Go for it, Carmen. Very interested in hearing what this is going to be, what you say.
Okay, I'm just going to share what works for our study group because we have gone into this. The science is talking about this field of all information, which is a field of frequency that is outside of the space-time segment of what we now understand as the universe. Anyway, in that field of all information is the equivalent of, I guess the best way to analogize it is the biggest supercomputer ever. It knows everything about us. It knows all of our brokenness. It knows all of our strengths. And it knows exactly how we will respond given a gazillion different X-factor influences in any situation. The course talks about every step of this has been planned. Even the moment of our enlightenment or awakening is already determined. And it's not that it's been determined for us. It's that it understands everything about us and has taken all of that into consideration. Even our mistakes have been included in the plan, and we're standing at the end of time, we're standing out of time in this field of all information, observing ourselves walking through this. To address the thing about form, it was, I didn't want to go into all the details, there was an awful lot of brokenness in that family. The man's physical condition, I believe, was the result of trying to escape all of the consequences of the mistakes that he had made in his life. And the reason why his ex-wife had sent me for the sake of their children was to ask him to consider that there was enough love in the family to bring him back into the fold and to value his strengths and the gifts that he had to give to his teenage sons. And that's the choice that he made, was to come back for that. It wasn't about healing his body so much as accepting the love that was being offered. My going to the hospital was a gesture of love that meant the world to the family. And I mean, just I can look back on it now and see how perfect it was. And he had the right to say no. But apparently he decided that he wanted to come back for the sake of his children. And they experienced an amazing healing as a result. It was everything that the course describes, and the physical healing was the proof to them that there was a power bigger than what they were aware of, and they called on it repeatedly in years to follow. And I just can't tell you how much it increased my faith watching that family. It wasn't about the physical healing, but the physical healing proved to them that there was a love greater than theirs, and they utilized it, and it's been a beautiful experience for me. So thank you.
Thank you, Carmen. Christian, okay, it doesn't explain, Christian writes, it doesn't answer the question of why ask Jesus what to do when all events are planned by God. It won't make any difference if all events are planned. Deb. Okay, all events. I'm wrestling with this, obviously, because there's two conceptual frameworks here, and I'm not entirely clear in my own mind exactly what the distinction that we need to look at is. The event that is planned by God is the atonement. And in order for the undoing, which is the atonement, the undoing of the separation illusion to occur, in order to overcome separation, we have to achieve unity through love, in love, with each other, with Jesus, with God. At that level, we know God's plan and we can act consistently with it. Part of God's plan is to give us free will and clearly the capacity to act contrary to his plan, contrary to atonement. We wouldn't need atonement if we hadn't achieved separation, which was consistent with God's will in that this gets into such elaborate theology, I don't know if we should even go here. The whole idea of learning, I mean, the plan is for us to learn. And we obviously need to learn because we've made mistakes. Did God plan for us to make mistakes? Well, I think it's clear that he gave us free will, fully knowing that we would not know how to use it, and that we needed a teaching environment in which we could learn how to use it, an environment in which we could not do any harm to ourselves or others, and that's Earth. It's a bit like a flight simulator used to train airline pilots. It feels like a real airplane. It looks like a real airplane when you're sitting in it. It acts like a real airplane when you're sitting in it. But when you make a mistake and crash it, you don't die. And you don't destroy an airplane. You learn how the mistake came to be. You learn how not to make the mistake. It comes to me, writes Christian, that the reason to ask what to do is to eliminate uncertainty / guilt / fear, not to change what happens. The reason I ask Jesus is because if I work from my ego, I do stupid, stupid things, thinking they're wonderful. If I ask Jesus, very frequently the result is, no, Doug, don't do it that way. Do it this way. So I have an option. I have will. I can do it my way or I can do it his way. His way will facilitate atonement. My way will just present another learning opportunity from my stupid things. Because God planned to give me... How can you do stupid things if they're planned by God? God did not plan my stupid things, I do not believe, at all. What God planned is that I would have the option, the choice, the free will, to make mistakes. How else can I learn how to do things right if I don't have the option to make mistakes? So that's part of God's plan, my capacity for being fearful, for being hateful, for being angry, for being mean and nasty. Does God want me to be mean and nasty? Is God asking me to be mean and nasty? No. God's plan gives me the option, and I can do it his way, which is loving, or the ego's way, which is fearful, and I see the results. And in seeing those results, I learn. So I don't think God planned every event means that God broke my leg when my leg got broken. I mean, obviously we're involved here too, right? God encompasses all of creation. There is a unity and a oneness. And sometimes the language just simply isn't adequate for the reality. God doesn't plan broken legs. No, God, in the sense of an external, all-powerful entity sitting up in the clouds, doesn't reach down and break anybody's leg. God is me. I am God. You are God. We are all God. And my mind can certainly create a broken leg. I wouldn't do it consciously, I don't think, at least not very often. But, I mean, one thing the Course clearly tells us is that an illness, or for that matter, almost any event, is a result of the mind. The mind is causal, and the mind is united with God. So I can't really separate my mind from God. That would be illusory. And that's the whole plan here, the whole atonement plan, is to correct that illusion, undo that illusion. And the plan, just take a week or so to sort it leave or to sort out your thoughts on the topic. All right. On that note, Deborah, here's the mic.
Okay, I have the lesson open here. You're talking about lesson 135.18, right, Kristen? Because I'll read it. Okay, I've got the urtext open. It says, defenses are the plans you undertake to make against the truth. So defenses are the plans you undertake to make against the truth. No, not that. Well, that's 135.18. Okay, then this is 135.16. The mind engaging in planning for itself is occupied in setting up control of future happenings. It does not think that you will be provided for unless it makes its own provisions. Time becomes a future emphasis to be controlled by learning and experiences obtained from past events and previous beliefs. It overlooks the present, for it rests on the idea that past has taught enough to let the mind direct its future course. No, not that, not that. Oh, Christ. Well, I'll go into what, just before I pass the mic to you, Christian, I'll go into what was coming to mind for me when Doug was talking here, and that was that everything happens, I hear repeatedly that everything happens perfectly according to the way it can happen, or everything's just perfect. But and what I'm understanding of that is that whatever my growth potential is, wherever my choice points are, I'm making choices all the time. I'm either with a certain learning or I'm not. So whatever movements I make, whatever way I join in this, the whole of it, what is being presented to me, then that's exactly what I needed to do in that moment to learn what I needed to learn. Otherwise, I'm not going to learn. If I step forward, whatever way I do that, I'm going to be in the position to learn whatever it is I'm going to learn, whatever error I make or whatever receiving I take in. So I don't know if that means anything here, but I'll pass you the mic on it.
Yeah, well, I don't think I have a lot to add because Doug has just posted the actual quote, which is page 255, workbook lesson 135, paragraph 18. What could you not accept if you but knew that everything that happens, including broken legs, everything that's been mentioned as unacceptable as being planned by God, everything that happens, including when I was mean and nasty, etc., all events, that means every single event that ever happens, past, present, and to come, are gently planned by one whose purpose is your good. I see Teddy saying he's not saying God. One who's capitalized is a reference to God in the Course in Miracles. Perhaps you have misunderstood his capitalized plan, his meaning God, because it's capitalized. For he capitalized, meaning God, would never offer pain to you. He would never offer pain to you. So the question originally, Doug, which I don't see any hope of being answered in this session because there's so much ridiculous disagreement on the board that it's not worthwhile, really. I see Teddy's constantly disagreeing with me that it's not God. I'm not really interested in having silly arguments that are not really well researched. But the original question, just to clarify then, Doug, which was an earnest question, was, you know, why ask what to do when it's all been planned? It's just a genuine question. Thank you.
Yeah, I understand it's a genuine question, and it deserves a genuine answer. And it is, I mean, it does appear basically contradictory, the idea that God is in charge and plans everything. And that line, it's hard for me to read it as meaning anything but God or the Holy Spirit, which is God, the Holy Spirit. All events, past, present, and to come, are gently planned by one whose only purpose is your good. Perhaps you have misunderstood his plan, for he would never offer you pain, capital his, capital he. But your defenses did not let you see his loving blessing shine in every step you took. And you made plans for death, he led you gently to eternal life. So there's two plans here, the plan you made and I made, and the plan God made. Whether that be God the Holy Spirit, God the Father, God the Son, there is a notion here clearly that reflects St. Paul's statement that all things work together for good to those who love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. And all things that happen, everything that I experience, I needed to experience. I absolutely know that. And if I break my leg, it's because I needed to break my leg. And that experience is exactly what I need in that moment, and it has something to teach me. The same way as if I'm a pilot in training and I'm sitting in the flight simulator and my instructor causes all of my engines to suddenly fail and I have to learn how to glide this airliner, I know that this was planned for my benefit, so that if it ever happens when I'm flying a real airplane, I'll know what to do. So I believe it's planned in that sense. The line, perhaps you have misunderstood his plan, for he would never offer pain to you, is significant because we often judge the thing that happens as the broken leg is bad. Damn it, it's inconvenient. I'm going to be late for my dentist appointment or whatever. Dentists, now they're bad. Teeth are bad. Bodies are bad. They get sick. All these things we judge as bad. And what we're being told there is, wait, hang on. And if I ask Jesus, I know exactly what would happen in that situation. If I fell and broke my leg and said, okay, Jesus, what's going on here? I mean, my ego is going to be cursing and swearing and annoyed and angry and frustrated and upset. And Jesus will say, well, there's a reason for this event, Doug. And just calm down and recognize that there's a reason, and you will see what it is. And who knows what the reason might be? I mean, the reasons could be any number of things, including stopping me before I run through a stop sign or something and get smucked by a car or whatever. I mean, you know, any number of things that I don't understand could be going on that are part of the plan of this action. But key in the plan is my mind, because my mind manifests my experience. And I think a key concept here is that while my mind does not necessarily control all events that pass in front of my eyes, my mind certainly controls my reaction to all events that pass before my eyes. And I can respond to the broken leg with fear and anger and annoyance, or I can respond by asking Jesus, what's it about? Help me understand this. Knowing that there is a blessing in it for me if I am capable of being aware that my judgment of this event as bad is my ego. It's not bad. Um, If you think you broke your leg, you broke your leg in the world of illusion. Actually, no. My leg is not an illusion. My illusion is my perception. It's not the thing itself. It's my perception of the thing. If it's not corrected by the Holy Spirit, it's an illusion. If my perception of my broken leg is corrected by the Holy Spirit, then it's real and true. And so the ego's perception of the bad would be an illusion. It's not bad. It has meaning. It has profound significance. If I can only recognize that my judgment of it is illusory, that the Holy Spirit's judgment will be definitely rather different, and if I can ask Jesus what the truth is, I will know, and I will recognize this broken leg as the great blessing to me that it inevitably is. That's what's being said here, I think, Christian. And so why ask Jesus? Because I won't understand anything if I don't. I will try to run the world according to my ego's judgment. And I know my ego's judgment fairly well, even if you don't. And if I was running the world by my ego's judgment, I don't think you'd like this planet at all. All right. Jesus sees what we don't see. All right, Deborah. Okay, we've been spending a lot of time, almost half an hour, on this question. And I see Lisa wants to contribute. So go for it, Lisa.
Hey, thank you, Christian. Thank you for posting that question. I'll be brief. I had that question myself, and so I asked internally to the Holy Spirit, you know, what is that about? Either everything happens for my good or it doesn't. Why would I have to do anything? And what I was told was that as long as I believe that I'm separate, I will think with a separate mentality. I will think with a will that is not fully aligned with my true will, which is God's will. And so what I'm being taught is in deciding against my true will, I'm being taught the consequence of that. I suffer, I get sick, I get scared, I get into fights with people, etc. And I learn more and more to follow and seek that guidance of the one true teacher within me. And so to ask for guidance on what to do and what to think and what to say is me really asking, what is my true will? What is my true way? What is my true plan? And that really, what could I not accept if I knew that everything really was planned for my highest good? That everything really was helps me to seek the guidance, knowing and trusting that everything will be provided as I truly desire it. So that is the reason why I was told that I need to seek guidance, so that I can listen to and rely on and eventually hear only one voice. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Lisa. I guess I'm to take the mic and continue reading here. Does that get this question answered? I'm just sending a link up here. I was multitasking. There we go. To Godchild, who just came in. So to be perfectly honest, folks, if everything is planned, I have no need to ask what to do, having no autonomy. Doug, here's the mic. That was what Kristen had written.
Okay, thanks for that clarification, Christian. Sometimes these kinds of questions, if we keep at them, they eventually get clear. The key element of the plan is your autonomy. And the notion that something other than you, over which you have no control and with which you have no communication, does it to you without your consent and participation, I think is the predestination idea that is so theologically toxic. That everything is planned by God. Every movement I make, every breath I take, every word I say is dictated by somebody other than me. I have no will, no freedom, no choice. So, I mean, why ask, why think, why breathe? Well, because I'm an automaton, programmed by God to do whatever. No, that's not what we're being told here about God's plan. That particular paragraph could be read in that way, but we have several thousand other pages of the Course with descriptions of God's plan and free will and how it all fits together. And the plan, the key element of the plan, is your free will, and this whole thing is set up for your learning and mine. And nothing happens outside of that plan is true, but my mind is part of that plan. Okay? My mind is part of that plan. And my mind is part of God. My higher self doesn't need to learn. It already knows. And is one with the Holy Spirit and God the Father and Jesus all at once. And it's my higher mind, my higher self, my soul, that says, Doug needs to learn this. So Doug is going to break his leg today because that's good for Doug. And I don't know that. But Doug, me, at ego level, definitely has complete freedom in how I'm going to respond to that broken leg. Absolute complete freedom. And I know at my ego level that I don't know how to respond. And only when I ask Jesus does a sane response cross my mind. Because my ego's responses are never sane. And the best response I can make at the level of perception and ego is to know that I can't make a good reaction, a clever reaction, a sane reaction, and to ask for guidance in how I can consciously be part of that plan rather than following my own plan for death in competition with that plan. Within which, I mean, it's like a plan within a plan within a plan here. But certainly this notion that we don't have free will and everything we do or say is, I mean, we're essentially, that would make us characters in a computer game controlled by the programmer. We'd be robots. And the entire experience would be totally meaningless. And I don't think that there's any way of reading the Course that can come up with that kind of a conclusion. So I think maybe it's time to go on with the reading.
Okay. Thanks, Kristen, for asking that question. I know you're off making tea, but maybe you can hear too. So we're going to continue on here at T1B24A. A miracle is a universal blessing from God through me to all my brothers. Explanation. You once said that souls cannot rest until everyone has found salvation. This happens to be true. It is the privilege of the forgiven to forgive. The disciples were officially and specifically told to heal others as physicians of the Lord. They were also told to heal themselves and were promised that I would never leave them or forsake them. Atonement is the natural profession of the children of God because they have professed me. 24b. Parentheses. Aside, tell Bill that this is what... Aside, tell Bill that that is what professor really means. As an associate professor, he must become associated with my strength. As an assistant professor, you must assist both him and me. The children need both strength and help. You cannot help until you are strong. The everlasting arms are your strength, and the wisdom of God is your help. Close parentheses. I wanted to draw attention to... It is the privilege of the forgiven to forgive. That is such a privilege to forgive. So every time that we think in terms of forgiving, it's that, wow, this is such a privilege to forgive. It's such a reversal on I have to forgive kind of approach that was always handed down in growing up from church. Hi, Paul. Doug, I didn't know if you wanted to comment on this little section. I guess not. I don't never know when your computer is acting up there. Here you go. Here's the mic.
Yes, we've had some acting up computers, and if anybody wants to pray for miracles, Doug needs a new computer. You can pray for that. yeah, it is the privilege of the forgiven to forgive. As souls cannot rest until everyone has found salvation. This happens to be true. It is the privilege of the forgiven to forgive. It's a profound statement, and forgiveness is often perceived and even presented as an obligation. This is what you must do, almost like a commandment. But it's a privilege. And the more you do it, the more you understand what a wondrous, delightful, magnificent, beneficent, pleasant experience it is to take that step from grievance and hostility and anger and annoyance through to forgiveness. That is the step from the world of sin and death, the ego made, to the real world created by God. That is the step through which we cease to see the world we made up, a world of sin and guilt, and we begin to see what the Course calls the forgiven world, which it characterizes as totally beautiful, harmonious, full of joy, the solution to every problem, even the gate of heaven. And it is a great privilege to step across that border. It's a border in our mind. It's all in our mind. The physical planet doesn't change as we take that step. The planet we perceive changes as we take that step. And instead of sin, we see love. Instead of illusion, we see reality. And that is the greatest privilege I can imagine. That is an all-important line. Yeah, definitely worth drawing attention to. Deborah.
Thank you. 24C. Heaven and earth shall pass away means that they will not always exist as separate states. My word, which is the resurrection and the life, shall not pass away because life is eternal. You are the work of God, and his work is wholly lovable and wholly loving. This is how a man must think of himself in his heart, because this is what he is. 24D. Add, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. Got to flip the page here. 24D-N1. So we're into some notes here. Lord, I will leave my desire to help him in your hands. If you will tell me what to do, I will to do it. 4DN2. And that, Azra, is the answer. The impact of this was incredibly intense, like a great burst of unexpected clarity. It was briefly so compelling that it seemed as though there was nothing else at all. The whole world just disappeared. Doug, here's the mic.
Well, I just again want to draw attention to that line. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. In one sense, one could say that one line summarizes A Course in Miracles in terms of the entire thought system about cause and effect. And if we equate heart to mind, you know, the Course doesn't very often use the word heart. Some other Jesus channelers do, and they make a distinction between heart and mind. But in the Course, mind and heart are basically rolled into one concept, the inner being, the one who wills and knows, the seat of consciousness. And what we're being told is thought is the only creative element in the universe. And those thoughts are of two kinds. The thoughts we think with God and the other kind. And depending on what thoughts are in our minds or hearts, that's what we are in our own perceptions. That's what we will perceive, and that's what we will create. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. So, if we think of ourselves as guilty, then we are. If we think of ourselves as sinners, then that's what we are. If we think of ourselves as holy sons of God, perfect in every way, and if we really think that, that's what we are. And we are the... We're holding the reins, folks. It's our mind. And we have a choice about what thoughts to think in every instant. Most of us probably aren't aware that we have a choice. The thoughts seem to come unbidden from a mysterious source, and they just show up in front of us, like you're sitting there watching the TV. But in fact, we're the programmer of the TV show. We choose what thoughts we want to think. And the Course is going to teach us a great deal about how to exercise that choice in a responsible, sane way, so as to bring about what we really want, which is love, peace, joy, harmony, reality, rather than illusions, mistakes, errors, misperceptions, grievances, sins, hatred, quarrels. Yeah, it's all in our hands. And thank goodness Jesus is there to help us, because as he says a number of times, without his help, we probably couldn't make it. All right. Deborah.
Okay. 24D and 4. When it faded out, there was no after effect except the dim sense of wonder, which also faded out, though a trifle slower. This is Helen talking here. I'm taking this as Helen speaking here, and when she's speaking, the images that come up, her sharing her process is really phenomenal. It just, like, she's so clear. She's so clearly seen inside. I love hearing her process. This is Helen's diary entry here, okay. I was told to write nothing else that evening, but would pick up the Course again in the morning. It was also explained that kind of experience is at the revelation level, which is different, but not by any means out of accord. Doug, here's the mic.
Yeah, this whole bolded segment is not part of Jesus' dictation for the most part. It is Helen's diary entry. And it starts with, Lord, I mean, I think we should take a look at this whole block, which I interrupted by commenting on something above it. Lord, I will leave my desire to help him in your hands. If you will tell me what to do, I will do it. That's Helen. The next line, and that, Azra, is the answer. And I don't know if that's Helen or Jesus. Azra is a name that is applied to Helen. Sometimes it seems to be in Jesus' voice, sometimes not. And I think it's Helen calling herself that, the same way she calls Louis Jonathan. And then she writes, the impact of this two lines, where she's basically praying, Lord, I will leave my desire to help him, and I'm not sure who him is in this case, in your hands. If you will tell me what to do, I will do it. That's asking Jesus. That's the answer. Ask Jesus. Offer your willingness. Leave your desire to help in his hands. Do what you're told. The impact of this was incredibly intense, Helen writes, like a great burst of unexpected clarity. It was briefly so compelling that it seemed as though there was nothing else at all. The whole world just disappeared. And when it faded out, there was no after effect except a dim sense of wonder, which also faded out, though a trifle more slowly. And then she says, I was told to write nothing else that evening, but we'd pick up the course again in the morning. It was also explained that that kind of experience is at the revelation level, which is different, but not by any means out of accord, different from what, I think what she's getting at is different from the miracle experience. Not out of accord, but different from the miracle experience. And part of that is that Jesus begins now a description, basically provides some definitions about miracles and revelations, what they are, and what distinguishes the one from the other. Different from a pure revelation, Lisa writes, could be, I'm not sure on that one. All right, Deborah, this takes us to 24E, which begins the instructions on sex, which all got edited out eventually, but most of it survives into the text. Okay, here is the microphone, Deborah. Here's how to do sex. Yes, Christian, exactly. Here's how to do sex. This is the course's sex manual.
I think this time around I'll get orgasm, rhythm, organism. I now see what I missed seeing before, instructions on sex. The relationship of miracles and revelations. 24E, remember the point about miracles as a means of organizing different levels of consciousness. Miracles come from the parentheses, below conscious, close parentheses, subconscious, close parentheses, level. Revelations come from the above, conscious level. The conscious level is in between and reacts to either sub- or superconscious impulses in varying ratios. Freud was right about the classification, but not the names. He was also right that the content of consciousness is fleeting. Consciousness is the level which engages in the world and is capable of responding to both external and internal impulses. Having no impulses from itself and being primarily a mechanism for inducing response, it can be very wrong. Doug, here's the mic.
I'm just remembering the first time I read that paragraph, and I thought, that's going to take me a couple of months to unscramble what's being said there. There's a couple of points I would like to stress that may not be entirely obvious at first. First of all, we're being given a map of the mind, a subconscious, a superconscious, and a conscious. And we're being told that consciousness is fleeting, that our mind consists of much, much more than that we're conscious of. And that miracles come from below the level of the conscious mind, whereas revelations come from above the level. Now, just what above and below mean here is not defined yet. It will be clarified to some extent. The key point here is that consciousness, what we're aware of, and what we normally think of as our minds, is not only not the entirety of our minds, it is, I'm trying to think of a metaphor, it is a tiny speck of the totality of our minds. It's almost like, think of a movie reel, an hour-long movie that's got a big 12-inch reel and it's got thousands and thousands of images. At any one moment, only one of those thousands of pictures is going to be displayed on the movie screen. That's what we're conscious of, that one fleeting moment, which passes into the next, which passes into the next. Over time, consciousness may entertain a great deal from below or above, but at any one moment, it's a tiny fragment. And that fragment is capable of responding to both external and internal impulses, but it has none from itself. That's also key. It's a responder. It's a reactor. It's an instrument that measures, notices, observes, perceives. And being primarily a mechanism for inducing response, it can be very wrong. So what we consciously think can be very wrong. Okay, that's what I wanted to say about that paragraph. It is complex. I could probably talk for hours on it, but let's move on. In Eastern systems, Teddy writes, everything takes place in consciousness awareness. Okay. I'm going to... Awareness and consciousness are different. What we're conscious of is what we're aware of, I think. Let's go to the next paragraph here.
Okay, 24F. For example, if the identification is with the body, consciousness may distort superconscious impulse by it denying their source and seeking their impact in the orgasm. This is the result of the mistaken identity confusion. 24G. If you will look back at the description of the effects of revelation, you will see that there are some similarities in the experiential results, but hardly in the content. 24H. Revelations induce complete but temporary suspension of doubt and fear. They represent the original form of communication between God and his souls before the intrusion of the fire and ice made this impossible. It should be noted that they involve an extremely personal sense of closeness to creation, which man tries to find in sexual relationships. This confusion is responding to depression and fear, which are often associated with sex. Here you go, Doug.
Okay, this is some amazingly significant stuff. Revelation is being compared to orgasm here. If you will look back at the description of the effects of revelation, you will see that there are some similarities in the experiential results, but hardly in the content. And in a variety of other comments, what we're being told here is that the miracle impulse and the sexual impulse are closely related. But the sexual impulse, of course, is strongly linked to the body, and superconscious impulses are linked to the divine. And consciousness may distort the one into the other, or mistake the one for the other, and understand superconscious influences as, seeking their impact in the orgasm, quite bluntly. The divine urge to love that exists within all of us can, under certain circumstances, be misdirected into an urge for sex. And the one is not the same as the other. That's basically what we're being told, though they have some similarities. Okay. Deborah. Now, Teddy, you're writing a lot, more than I can read. And if you want to pipe up, we've got 6 minutes left if you want to take the mic.
Oh, but Teddy, you share good things. Do you want the mic? Okay, I guess not. Then what I'll do is carry on. I'd like to hear what you have to say. Okay, thanks, Teddy. 24I.
Sex is often associated with lack of love, but revelation is purely a love experience. Physical closeness cannot achieve this. As was said before, the subconscious impulses properly induce miracles, which are personal and result in closeness to others. This can be misunderstood by a personally willful consciousness as an impulse towards sexual gratification. Doug, here's the mic.
Well, here we're basically being told the same thing again, somewhat more clearly. And it begins with that notion that sex is often associated with a lack of love. And let's think about what that means. Sexual impulses at the body level have nothing necessarily to do with love. I mean, they're basically hormonal driven, and physical sexual attraction can occur and does occur for many people without even knowing the person, let alone loving the person you're attracted to. I mean, a photograph in a magazine can be enough to trigger a sexual response sometimes. And clearly there's not a lot of love involved with that. Revelation, by contrast, is purely a love experience. It has no physical component. And physical closeness cannot achieve a love experience. It can achieve a physical experience, but it cannot achieve a love experience. As was said before, the subconscious impulses properly induce miracles, which are interpersonal and do result in closeness to others. The miracle brings us close. They are relational. They involve a relationship. And as Deborah pointed out earlier, the recipient of a miracle and the conduit of the miracle both benefit from the miracle. The way two people who have a great conversation both benefit from the conversation. It's not a one-way street. It is an interactive, reciprocal arrangement, so, which results in closeness. When two people are united or relate at the level of miracle, there is closeness, which can be misunderstood by a personally willful consciousness as an impulse towards sexual gratification. So we're being advised again, and we will be yet further, about this hazard of mistaking the love, the exchange of love, with sexual attraction, which I think probably everybody has recognizes can happen. All right, we've got 2 minutes left. I think we're going to have to say, going to have to stop here. And I think next week we'll start at 24E and begin the instructions on sex again, because the whole thing should be dealt with as a unit. So I would like to thank everybody for showing up, for your participation. Christian raised a great question tonight about predestination and what does do all things are planned mean. And I think I'm going to put some effort this week into trying to come up with a better answer for that one, Christian, because it is a very significant question. And again, thank you all for being here and for sharing this experience with us and making your contributions. And Deborah, I'm going to give you the mic for your goodbyes.
I want to thank everybody who has participated in this room, and I also want to thank everyone who is participating from the radio and listening and adding your energy in. And also Doug for pulling this particular session together and doing all of the work he's done, and for Dove in offering this gathering opportunity to us all. That's really fantastic. For Helen and Bill for listening so diligently to Jesus and bringing us this information. It's so phenomenal. So thanks, everybody. And this will be continued. Carmen, you're up next, I think, because you got your video up there, and I'm going to miss your session because I got to rush off. So I hopefully that's being taped. Is that being taped someplace? I'd really like to know, because I'd like to listen to it later. Thanks, everybody. All my love. Bye.